special guest star Steve Argue, and some call-ins on the upcoming political race. Perhaps also some calls from Portland and Santa Barbara. We're going to find out about that soon. Stay with us for 3.5 hours of Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides.
I went down to Chance Bodega, a funky corner store. I walked in and what I saw, it knocked me to the floor. Lots of jars full of cigars at $30 each. A neon sign imported wine. A funky corner store. I walked in and what I saw, it knocked me to the floor. Lots of jars full of cigars at $30 each. A neon sign imported wine and microbrewery cheese. And there's no more single cigarettes and no more bargain beer. The writing's on the wall, my friends, the end is drawing near. SUVs are everywhere, old trucks cannot be found. This is not the place where I grew up, I don't know my own hometown. Just look and you can see it, you can watch the city die. Shady Gotham's office, it's enough to make you cry. Where once there was a mural, there's a mad designer. Hell, the city that I knew is gone, this city is for sale. Apartments, condos, condos, they burn down cheap hotels. Yuppies take the south side and the city goes to hell. Yuppies take the south side and the city goes to for a ham and cheese on rye. But it's got a new name, Peak of the Range. It's a high concept design. It's full of rocks, it's a mountaintop, and clouds go rolling by. Got Alpine cuisine, I saw limousines, and it's full of guys and ties. Just look and you can see it, you can watch the city die. Hey, we got new bosses, it's enough to make you cry. Where once there was a mural, there's a mad designer. Hell, the city that I knew is gone, the city is for sale. Apartments gone to condos, they burn down cheap hotels. Yuppies take the south side, and the city goes to hell. Yuppies take the south side, and the city goes to hell. Yuppies take the south side, and the city goes to hell.
And that's City for Sale from the album of the same name by the San Francisco Mime Troupe. It's about San Francisco, but it's also about Santa Cruz and any other city where yuppie gentrification is threatening to drive out people who've lived there for years, destroy the culture that has been there, and set up essentially a profit machine for a few real estate speculators and trinket salespeople. It's what's happening in a lot of seaside towns. It's what we don't want to happen in Santa Cruz. It's what's behind laws like the downtown ordinances masquerading as concerns about health, safety, and decorum. It actually has to do with class and the visibility of people who, the very presence of whom, is obnoxious, offensive, and intolerable to some conservative folks who patronize the stores, and the merchants want to cater to those folks, and then, of course, it's okay to eliminate a class of people who offend their sight. And the claim, of course, is it's behavior, but, of course, behavior that is assaultive or abusive is already covered by existing law, was already covered by law previous to the current noxious downtown ordinances I should say the previous ones that were passed by Neil Coonerty and Scott Kennedy back in 1994, as well as Mike Rotkin. And what we have now is a struggle to reestablish a sense of sanity downtown and to restore basic rights to folks who want to use the downtown for a variety of purposes and not simply have it be a doormat for the merchants and the commercial interests who fundamentally want to change the basic character of the town, or if they don't, are doing so in spite of themselves. I'm Robert Norris. This is Free Radio Santa Cruz. You're tuned to 96.3 FM. For the next 3.5 hours or so, you're going to be able to call in, listen in, and hopefully be a part of a network that does something to stop this gentrification process and to forward the process of actually getting some basic human rights restored for poorer people in terms of how rent control or other similar kinds of measures, rent stabilization, might lessen the burden and allow for actual community here rather than commuting in from Gilroy to do the jobs that the city needs to do and drive away much of the population as it's now doing, as well as the other focus of the show, of course, is civil rights on the streets in terms of homeless people and how they are treated every day and every night, not just by your occasional off-kilter, thuggish police officer, security guard, or misguided host, but generally by a whole system here in Santa Cruz, which criminalizes people at night, after 11 o'clock at night, and which now criminalizes them during the day if they sit down or lie down, if they lie down at all, but if they sit down 14 feet from a business on any sidewalk anywhere in town, and of course after dark in the parks, all the parks close after dark. It's a closed town to people below a certain income after dark in Santa Cruz, and they're making it more unwelcome during the daytime hours. I'd like to hear your thoughts on this, 427-3772. We're going to be listening to some interviews and kind of running over some of the upcoming city council races. There are forums coming up, the SCAN forum, Santa Cruz Action Network. It's actually, I guess, this year a progressive coalition forum, which consists of SCAN and a bunch of other groups, which have given out a questionnaire to the candidates. And Free Radio Santa Cruz, or at least my tiny portion of Free Radio Santa Cruz, Bathrobes, Piers, Broadsides, my show here, is going to be issuing an invitation to the candidates to discuss these civil rights issues on the air. We've already talked to at least four of them, Thomas Levitt, Phil Baer, Steve Argue, and actually I had a brief interview with Aldo, I don't want to mispronounce his name, his name is Aldo, is it Giacchino or Giacchino? I'm not sure. Tried to get him on the air. We called him at least twice. He hasn't gotten back. He did give us a brief interview at the courthouse on Friday when he lost his challenge to Cynthia Matthews and Mike Rotkin, a challenge that, in essence, sought to have them disqualified from running this year because they have not yet sat out to a full two-year term, which would put them beyond the current election process, and they'd have to wait another term. A lot of us don't like Matthews and Rotkin, and for that reason alone, tend to be, have been sympathetic to this challenge, although, of course, the broader issue is as important as its impact on these particular bad candidates. Should good candidates, for example, be allowed to run? I mean, the FDR issue, there are a lot of people who supported the FDR, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and felt he should be able to run for four terms, and the Republicans passed the national constitutional amendments that prohibited that. And there's arguments pro and con. The argument about having the recycled politicians in power is that they their name recognition and their kind of insider connections make them a liability to the community, and yet easier to elect because they are more savvy, because they have better media contacts, more financial punch, that sort of thing. The argument, you know, another argument on that side of the ledger is that people are best advised to allow new blood and new faces in. Against that argument is the fact that it takes money at least to run for, for example, federal or state office, and if you have to raise huge amounts of money every year, you're going to have to do that anyway, so I suppose that's not so much of an argument. I guess the argument is that you don't really understand the political process until you've been there for a while, and if you suddenly have to leave after being there only one or two terms, that's a liability for the public, and then you get inexperienced clotheads in, like some would call Fitzmaurice, Crone, and Sugar, Riley, and Porter. The question is, do you want the bumblers who are ready to be manipulated by the staff, or the longtime politicos who've already been subverted by the staff, like Kennedy, Rodkin, and Matthews? And I don't know. It's a bad series of choices, and I don't know what the actual answer is. Maybe some of you out there have some ideas. 427-3772. We've invited the candidates to call in on this SCAN forum questionnaire, which I'm going to be coming to probably in a bit. The Progressive Coalition, actually. And the Progressive Coalition includes Central Labor Council, Democratic Central Committee, Green Party, People's Democratic Club, Santa Cruz Action Network, and Service Employees International Union. And the NAACP is going to be participating, though they won't be endorsing candidates. And all this is going to happen 7 to 9 a week from tomorrow, on Monday, in Loudoun Nelson Center Auditorium, which is actually around the same time that there's going to be a mass protest against the downtown ordinances and a birthday party for the Saturn, kind of a big mix of stuff designed to encourage people to show up on the streets and reclaim the streets for the community, not just for the merchants, the police, and the staff and city council hierarchy in the downtown association. So Thomas Levitt is out of town, and Phil Baer I guess we can ask him his thoughts on these questions, too. The questions range from transportation to water to downtown Santa Cruz commercial development, electoral process, homeless needs, affordable housing, budget, ballot measures, labor, community relations. And we're going to obviously, at least obvious from my perspective, and if you've been listening to the show, obvious from yours, focus on a few, such as electoral process, downtown Santa Cruz commercial development, homeless needs, and affordable housing is probably going to be the main focus, though ballot measures and budget will come into it, and labor comes into it. In a way, it's all kind of tangled up in one big ball of wax, and we're going to be talking about that a bit later in the show. Bad news for all you folks who've been following AB 1421. I have not really gotten a definitive word from anybody who's in Sacramento, it being the weekend, but the word from the internet, where I went to the government site to find out what was cooking, was that the assembly passed the bill, the final version of the bill, on Friday. And I actually have some stats here, if I can find them. I hope I do. It passed pretty overwhelmingly. I think there were four senators, there were eight senators and four assembly people. I've got the bill that passed, but the longer version that I thought I had with me doesn't seem to be here. But it passed on Friday, and it presumably goes to the governor for signature. And I guess people can still urge Governor Prison Guards are my religion Davis to veto the bill, and hopefully he will. But that hope shouldn't be something you put a lot of money on. And we have this very nasty AB 1421 coming at us, broadsiding us. The actual folks who have been kind of keeping an eye on it, I think, may have been left napping, because it suddenly zipped out of the Appropriations and Judicial Committee onto the Senate floor, was passed, and then quickly moved over to the Assembly this last week and was passed there as well. What this bill does is it enacts the Assisted Outpatient Treatment Demonstration Project Act of 2002, which supposedly creates an assisted outpatient treatment program for any person suffering from a mental disorder and meets certain criteria. It's actually, as I pointed out before, a needles on wheels bill that essentially mandates compulsory forced medication for people who have been hospitalized twice and who don't even meet the standards of dangerousness to self, others, or grave disability that would currently be required even to put them to incarcerate them. And then once they're incarcerated, then they have to make a showing that they need this forced medication as the, I guess, least restrictive alternative, or at least the folks in the hospital get a Reese hearing where you're able to claim you don't need the medication or you can proceed on some other course of treatment. But this gives essentially police and medical authorities, the power to get courts to order mandatory, involuntary outpatient commitment therapy. Therapy, of course, means lots of money for the pharmaceutical companies and presumably more funding for certain aspects of the mental health system, although there's no more funding included in this bill, which is sort of the big joke. It's going to cost huge amounts of money to send cops and nurses around and then take people to court who refuse to do this and commit them when they refuse to do it. Because that's you get to be taken away for 72 hours if you don't take your meds as the police show up at your door. I'm trying to see when this goes into effect. It's a long, small type bill. And I thought I had this said in a better form, and I did when I did it last night, but unfortunately I don't have the details of that with me here. I'm assuming it probably goes into effect in January of 2003. Let's see, more details about this nasty bill. The program would operate in counties that chose to, quote, provide the services. I guess that means the police squad cars, ambulances, pharmaceutical needles and such, and make their wards available. So presumably Santa Cruz County could opt out of this. So I guess the next step for folks in Santa Cruz is to demand the Board of Supervisors opt out of this whole thing. And I don't quite know what that process is, but people should get in touch with their Board of Supervisor clown, clone, or stupid viper, as I call them, of your choice. Call me adolescent. I like to think of myself as realistic. And ask them to just say no to needles on wheels in Santa Cruz. Fred Keeley, by the way, our assemblyman, voted for this bill. Bruce McPherson did not vote for it, but he did not vote against it. He was absent at the time. And so I don't quite know. He may have been keeping a low profile, or maybe that's some other business he had to attend to. For the purposes of fairness, I'll read you what they say about the bill in terms of its description. Existing law, the Lanterman-Petras Short Act, makes a provision for the involuntary treatment of any person with a mental disorder who, as a result of a mental disorder, is a danger to others, to himself or herself, or is gravely disabled. This bill, until January 1, 2008, when it sunsets, would enact the Assisted Outpatient Treatment Demonstration Project Act of 2002, which would cause an assisted outpatient treatment program for any person who is suffering from a mental disorder and meets certain criteria. The program would operate in counties that chose to provide the services. The program would involve the delivery of community-based care by multidisciplinary teams of highly trained mental health professionals with staff-to-client ratios of not more than 1 to 10 and would specify requirements for the patient alleging the necessity of treatment, various rights of the person who is the subject of the petition, and hearing procedures. The bill would also provide for settlement agreements as an alternative to the hearing process. This bill would provide that if the person who is the subject of the petition fails to comply with outpatient treatment, despite efforts to solicit compliance, a licensed mental health treatment provider may request that the person be placed under a 72-hour hold based on an involuntary commitment. This bill would also require each county operating an outpatient treatment program pursuant to the bill to provide certain data to the State Department of Mental Health, would impose requirements upon the department to report to the legislature. The bill would also require the department to develop a specified training and education program for use in counties participating in the program pursuant to the bill. There's no appropriation, as I said, for this. It's based supposedly on the RAND Corporation report commissioned by the California Senate Committee on Rules titled The Effectiveness of Involuntary Outpatient Treatment, Empirical Evidence, and the Experience of 8 States. We actually had an interview with activist David Bush of Southern California, who was vigorously lobbying against this bill, and he found that the RAND Corporation study didn't have time to talk about it at length, but his statement was that it was being misused and was also misleading here, that in fact what's happened is the increase in treatment facilities that have been made available gets people interested, not the fact that there's coercion involved and that they have to do it. I have not read the study thoroughly. I've read some of the critics. I haven't done a lot of reading of the proponents. I've read a little bit. I'm kind of just giving you the overview of this AB 1421 bill, the Needles on Wheels bill, as I call it, that passed on Friday, the Assembly, and is now presumably going to be, I'm presuming it's going to be signed by the governor, but since it was passed by such an overwhelming majority. But if you know of any way to influence our good Governor Davis, give him a call or email or fax him and tell him to just dump this sucker, because it's going to be extremely expensive. It's going to discourage people from seeking treatment, and of course it's a wholesale violation of civil rights and civil liberties, particularly for poor and homeless people who frequently they're under more pressure than a lot of us, and they can get caught up in police networks, whether it's the drug war or the mental health war. Again, gentrification is a big issue here. It's nice to get those people who look unsightly and act a little weird off the streets and out of the way. So it has a lot of impact, I think, on you out there, whether you know it or not yet. AB 1421. Let's see what we got here. So, the deal is this. It's also known as Laura's Law. That's written into the law. It's called assisted outpatient treatment. That's like when they assist you in jail to move from one cell to another. They ain't assisting you. They are moving you whether you like it or not. In any county which services are available, as provided in Section 5348, a court may order a person who is the subject of a petition filed pursuant to the section to obtain assisted outpatient treatment, which means you take your meds or you go back to 72-hour hold, even if you're not a danger to yourself, others, or gravely disabled. If the court finds, by clear and convincing evidence, that the facts stated in the verified petition are true and establish all the requisite criteria, which include, you've got to be 18 years or older, you've got to suffer from a mental illness, there has to have been a clinical determination that you are unlikely to survive safely in the community without supervision. Notice that's different than being gravely disabled. It's a much weaker standard. Unlikely to survive safely. Seems like it. Well, I mean, maybe it's not. Maybe it's the same standard. It certainly isn't quite what gravely disabled is, and I guess we need some people to talk about that. The person has a history of lack of compliance with treatment for her or his mental illness, in that at least one of the following is true. The person's mental illness has at least twice in the last 36 months been a substantial factor in necessitating hospitalization or receipt of services in a forensic or other mental health unit or a state correctional facility or local correctional facility, not including any period during which the person was hospitalized or incarcerated immediately preceding the filing of the petition. So if you've been hospitalized twice prior to the latest time they pick you up and you're not taking your meds, that can be the basis. At least that's the criteria they're talking about. If your mental illness has resulted in one or more serious or violent behavior towards yourself or another, or threats or attempts to cause serious physical harm to yourself or another within the last 48 months, not including the period during which you were hospitalized or incarcerated, immediately preceding the filing of the petition. So if you've just threatened to do things within the last 48 months and you have a mental illness, so-called, as specified by a mental health professional, if you have been offered an opportunity to participate in a treatment program and you have failed to engage in that treatment, if your condition is substantially deteriorating, again, according to the mental health professional, and if participation in this program would be the least restrictive placement necessary to ensure your recovery and stability, again, a matter of simply so-called clear and convincing evidence by the physician. And physicians, of course, are given great weight and great respect by judges. In view of the person's treatment history and current behavior, the person is in need of assisted outpatient treatment in order to prevent a relapse or deterioration that would be likely to result in grave disability or serious harm to himself or to others. So if they think you might relapse, that's another requirement. And it is likely the person will benefit from the assisted outpatient treatment. So then they get a petition goes to the Superior Court. The people who can make this petition are anybody 18 years or older who lives with you. If your roommate thinks you're a little too weird and you're not taking your meds, he can take you to court. Any person who is the parent, spouse, or sibling of you can do it. Watch out for your relatives. The director of any public or private agency, treatment facility, charitable organization, or licensed residential care facility providing mental health services to you can do it. A licensed mental health treatment provider who is either supervising the treatment or treating you for a mental illness, a police officer, peace officer, parole officer, or probation officer. A lot of people, cops, relatives, roommates, can file for this petition. This is something that we want Santa Cruz County to opt out of. Definitely convinced of. If you have any thoughts yourself on this, you can give a call, 427-3772. We're talking about AB 1421, Needles on Wheels, or Laura's Law, which looks like, barring a stroke of lightning at the governor's house, wouldn't it be interesting? We're going to get this bill, and it's going to go into force in January. Not good. And I'm sorry that I didn't catch this sooner. I have been mentioning this bill occasionally on the air. And again, there have been numerous organizations lobbying against this bill. Client groups who believe in rights for people labeled mentally ill, people seeking different kinds of treatment who aren't of the belief that the great wonder drugs, Thorazine, lithium, Zyprexin, all these fine drugs are necessarily something we want to hand over our lives to, and the mental health professionals as well. Not saying that one shouldn't use whatever medications one finds effective in one's own case, but to have these forced on you is so profound a violation of the dignity of the person that I shudder to think of it. And along that lines, John Stewart, an activist who some of you may remember from 5 or 6 years ago, who was doing a lot of organizing with a group called, I guess, was it Madness Liberation Front? He was doing good, then got into some troubles, and now he's being held on a psych ward and coming back for a habeas corpus hearing, which means he wants to be released and allowed back into the community. It's not an easy situation. I saw John on the streets, and he looked pretty wing-nutty to me and pretty wild and crazy, and I was worried for him, and I wasn't prepared to take care of him, and I don't know what the answer is, but it isn't forced medication, and it isn't forced incarceration. It's some kind of real commitment of community resources to make alternatives available, I think. But what do you think? 427-3772. You're tuned to Free Radio Santa Cruz. Let's hear a little bit from the Mime Troupe.
Who are you?
Gene Renfrew, Coast City Courier. I'm here to ask the president some real tough questions.
Take care, Mr. Renfield. You are new to the White House press corps and do not know our ways. There are things here you do not understand. Questions you must not ask.
Yeah, but...
We don't use big words or funny foreign names or follow up on questions and shoot him down in flames. We never, ever notice when what he says is wrong. If you want to keep your job, just watch and go along. If we want to keep our job, shut up and go along.
He will destroy us all. Shut up and go along.
Ladies.
ladies and gentlemen.
What are you guys so afraid of?
The President of the United States.
I'd like to thank you all for coming. First, let me just say that I've had a lot of articles from your newspapers read to me recently that say that this president doesn't care. Not true. The last president may have felt the nation's pain, but this administration promises to be responsible for it. So please feel free to ask me any of your little questions.
From the Bugle, I have a question to ask Mr. President, and I pray that you will not find me impertinent. There's a controversy that's growing hot and hotter about levels of arsenic in our drinking water.
Study all kinds of pollution, but let's not run to the government for every solution. We see this not as a problem, but an opportunity to put our trust in the corporate community.
Put our trust in the corporate community, the corporate community.
I'm sure some corporation will put things back in kilter by coming up with some kind of arsenic filter that every family in the country, and this you can't rebut, will have money for that filter, 'cause of my big old tax cut.
O'Reilly from the Tribune. In terms of prioritization, you've said your administration thinks that children's education stands at number one, with $1,500 vouchers that you give the little slouchers. Improve the education of every daughter and son.
It's time to end the tyranny of a country's public schools, who turn out illiterates, losers and fools. Let us give to the parents some power and some money to choose a private school for their little sis and sonny.
They can choose a school for little sis and sonny, for little sis and sonny.
I know $1,500 won't pay the whole. But they'll have plenty extra money with my big old tax cut. I wanna sing and dance, I just wanna strut every time I think about that big old tax cut.
Mr. President, Gene Radfield, Coast City Courier. There's a federal commission that has a stated mission to control the cost of power for the public good. Will your administration support the regulation of the rising cost of power like you know you could?
Price caps, we don't go there.
People gotta pay what the market will bear. Want low power prices and your gas tanks fill. What we gotta do is mine and drill.
What we gotta do is mine and drill, mine and drill.
You know California is on my mind. You know that I'm compassionate, you know that I'm kind. If they're gonna pay their bills, they're gonna need more bucks, and that's what they'll get with my big old tax cut. I gotta sing and dance, I just gotta strut every time I think about that big tax cut.
For most working families who wear blue collars, the tax cut amounts to $300.
Well, I'm getting a lot more than that.
Does the lack of regulation of the energy corporations reflect the lot of nations that bought you your win?
No comment.
How about renewables like solar and wind?
Are there any other
questions?
How
about an answer that's not just speed?
How about an answer that's not just speed? How about an answer that's not just speed?
Who is this asshole anyway?
How about an answer that's not just speed?
Oh,
And that was press conference from 1600 Transylvania Avenue. You tune to Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM. You want to call in? We have an open line, 427-3772. I'm your host, Bathrobes Peer Robert Norris. A lot of topics today ranging from the Needles on Wheels bill you heard me talk about, the new AB 1421 that we definitely want our county to opt out of, to the perennial basic issues that keep showing up every night, the need for people to have legal places to sleep at night, the need for people to have fair treatment from police authorities, local businesses, local government, the kind of discrimination that people suffer daily. Here's a interview from the courthouse. I actually went to court myself on Friday. There was a couple things happened on Friday that I'm going to be reporting on. One is the progress of the Downtown Commission, the appointed group of individuals who are supposed to be the people to whom issues affecting the downtown first go, but the Emily Riley gentrification laws, the downtown ordinances that they passed in July through City Council in the amazingly fast time of 15 days with four hearings. Normally you have a City Council meeting every 2 weeks, but they crammed four into 15 days to get these things passed. Downtown Commission was supposed to look at these ordinances first, but they didn't hear anything about them until they were suddenly told they have to have a rushy four meetings in the month, more or less, to kind of iron out the kinks that came along with the rushed process that the City Council did. And it's actually good news from the Downtown Commission. I spoke about it yesterday on Steve Argue's morning show. Steve, council candidate and activist locally, has a show from 8 to 10 on Saturday mornings on Free Radio, and he was good enough to give me a few moments of airtime to talk about it, and I kind of gave a brief update then. I'm going to repeat and expand that update now here on the air. The Downtown Commission held its fourth meeting from 8:30 to, I guess, about 10:30 on Friday. And it was, of course, a very inconvenient time, but the room was filled anyway. It wasn't packed, but it was filled. Almost all the seats were filled. And a lot of people there, some merchants, some residents, a number of critics of the ordinance, some staff members. I don't think the chief of police or Parks and Rec or anything was there, although they may have been in the wings, because on the agenda was the leaning ordinance. There were two things on the agenda, actually: exemptions and the leaning ordinance. And the leaning ordinance was the one ordinance that wasn't rubber-stamped by the council. And when I say rubber-stamped, I mean rubber-stamped. Not a comma was changed of all the ordinances that came apparently directly out of the police department or the redevelopment agency and onto the City Council floor without even stopping in the Riley Porter Committee. The public had no indication that Porter had been, holed up with law enforcement authorities for months before, apparently preparing these absurd laws that have nothing to do with violent behavior or vandalism or even rudeness, but have everything to do with gentrifying the downtown and, convincing merchants to vote against utility tax repeal or something. I mean, it's some sort of political shenanigan around election time to be done when the students are away. And a lot of people are very angry about it, and properly so. Of course, the previous downtown ordinances were nothing to shout about either. They needed to be dumped, and that issue was raised in the Homeless Issues Task Force meetings of 2 years ago, which put a lot of time and energy into looking into recommendations which the City Council completely ignored. So while the City Council can ignore recommendations that take 8 or 9 months to prepare, when it comes to stuff that is cooked up secretly in the police department and the redevelopment agency, they can ram that through in 15 days. It says something really horrible about the process in Santa Cruz, and even more horrible is that this is done by progressives, people who call themselves progressives. It's Morris, Porter, Riley. I guess Kennedy and Premack can't really be put in that bag, though Kennedy loves to assume that mantle of progressivism, even though he split with the so-called Three Amigos and the SCAN majority back in 1998 with the Beach South of Laurel plan and numerous other things. And we're hoping actually to have on the air Fred Geiger later today if he wants to call in. He was going to talk about some of these issues. He's a sort of a longtime political observer and participant, part of the constituent support group for Crone and Sugar. And disappointed member of the community in what was done. At least that's how he's represented himself to me, and I think it's probably true to say. Downtown Commission is what I'm talking about at the moment. I don't quite have the tape for this because they're not going to have it ready until Monday. I did do some taping during this 8:30 to 10:30 Friday meeting of the Downtown Commission 2 days ago, their fourth meeting on these absurd exemptions. That is to say, where will we say you don't have to bring a tape measure with you to decide that you're not 14 feet from a building, 14 feet from a kiosk, 14 feet from a bench, 14 feet from a crosswalk, in the tiny areas left that the city council has not ruled out as forbidden zones for homeless people, street performers, political tablers, anybody with a non-commercial display, anybody giving out political literature. I suppose it's okay to talk about this. I would actually kind of think what I'm going to do is I'm going to talk about it, and then I'm going to set up a little bit of tape, because the tape I made is very hard to hear, and I'm going to wait for the much better quality official tape that will come out. But I will be able to give you, we will be able to hear the brief oral communications session that the Kathy Bisbee's Downtown Commission, she's the chair, allowed. That brief session, she did the usual crone number. Instead of allowing ample oral communications time, she limited it to 2 minutes per person. And then she didn't really clarify to people what was on the agenda, so she didn't make it clear to people that they could talk about virtually every aspect of the downtown ordinances except for the leaning law and the exemptions. Exemptions, again, is they were talking about exemptions not for people who are poor, mind you. No. Not for people who are homeless in terms of the places they could sit. But the politically correct political activists and the commercially helpful street musicians. And the exempted zones included places ranging from streetlights records area to the bookshop Santa Cruz. These are the areas under discussion. And there was a well-publicized article. It was well-placed in the paper by Dan White. Dare we call him Dim White? I don't know. I do know. I just I guess I'm a little reluctant to say. Dan White's article in the Sentinel described this as, city tries to tune up street music rules, panel hits sour note in effort to ease restrictions on players. And that's in the Saturday Sentinel, above the fold story. Dan misses, of course, key facts as usual, but it's interesting that his story begins, the city's attempt to propose exemption spaces for downtown performers and political tables has led to confusion, lawsuit concerns, and a First Amendment debate. In mid-September, new downtown rules, reactions to aggressive panhandling, criminal and social problems downtown, again, I think he gets that one wrong, will ban hacky sack, increase space restrictions on panhandlers, and ban sign-holding panhandlers after dark. But the rules also tighten space limits for non-commercial display, including musicians and people with tables who say they are being forced out of their favorite spots. Revised display rules would make some spots off-limits by keeping tables and musicians 14 feet from benches, kiosks, building entrances, and crosswalks. And he might have added drinking fountains and telephones, which are also included. And also, as is true, but was not, actually was falsely misrepresented by Assistant City Attorney Martine Bernal, there is also non-commercial activity as well as non-commercial displays is prohibited. So you don't have to have just a guitar case display or a table display to be within the 14-foot forbidden zone prohibition. If you are walking around giving out literature, if you are walking around singing or playing a guitar without a case, or a flute without a case, without anything whatsoever, that's considered non-commercial activity, and it is also barred within the 14-foot zones. And this is something that Martine Bernal might say he lied about it, because he said this kind of activity isn't covered, but it is covered. It is, in fact, the straight wording of the law that it's covered. I actually presented this law to Mayor Crone, who was in attendance at this downtown commission meeting. Mark Premack refused to take a copy, but it's still the law, even though Mark apparently doesn't want to acknowledge that, or at least not from me. And I'm going to read it to you again. I've read it before. It's a pretty key section of the non-commercial ordinance, and it's currently the law. That is to say, it was the law before the downtown ordinances were passed. The downtown ordinances passed in July are actually on the books now. They came on the books on August 23rd, but they will not be officially enforced, says the resolution that passed, until September 10th. But they can be enforced by citizens and by police, really, at any time. It's a matter of the individual choice, because they're on the books and they're legal. But the advice by the city manager is not to enforce them, and the direction by the city council is not to enforce them, but that doesn't mean, because it was... religious, other public service, or charitable activity, including speech or the distribution of literature, whether or not such activity is conducted with the assistance of a display device, and where the use is conducted for either the sale of merchandise or the solicitation of donations, is barred within 14 feet of a building entrance, fence, street corner, intersection, window, kiosk, mid-block, crosswalk, drinking fountain, public telephone, bench, vending cart, or outdoor sidewalk cafe. So it's not just displays. It's behavior that is barred. Now, such behavior was barred before, but it was only barred from a 6-foot radius of buildings. And so, in effect, I never saw the issue come up. And it may not have come up because the city police realized it might be a real constitutional nightmare to try to enforce it. They did enforce it when displays, so-called displays like tables or a blanket on the sidewalk with literature on it, or a guitar case, let's say, or something like that was out there. But those were displays, and they asked that those displays be 6 feet from this and 6 feet from that, and we did that. In fact, that was something that I very carefully adhered to when I set up a table outside Sushi Now in front of New Leaf Market, asking that people boycott Sushi Now, Alibaba's Cafe, and New Leaf Market because of their support for the Forbidden Fence. And by the way, I still support such a boycott, encourage you to not only support such a boycott, but make it very verbally clear what you're doing when you pass those businesses. That's called free speech, and don't do so in a threatening manner, but do so in an informative manner. Tell people it's not appropriate to patronize businesses that seize public space in order to get rid of a class of young people and homeless people. It's not right. It's not in accord with traditional mores. It's incredibly hypocritical for New Leaf Market. And it doesn't solve the problem either. Turning this into a gated, gentrified community is not the answer. And those who have that answer and who impose it on the community through bad processes and compliant, politically pandering city council members need to be given a wake-up call. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, Robert. You referred to Martine Bernal as assistant city attorney, but actually he's assistant city manager.
That's correct. I apologize. Thank you for the correction.
I've had some dealings with him, and I call him the chief obfuscator, and I found that... He's really good at pretending to say one thing, and he's good at lying, let's put it that way.
Where has he misrepresented himself in your dealings?
I had a problem with a bogus traffic ticket from the police, and I complained up the chain of command, as it were, talking to him.
Caller, let me get you to speak up, because I'm afraid everybody's hearing my booming voice but having trouble hearing yours.
Okay. I have a cold anyway, but...
Sorry about that.
I spoke to him in his office, and I said, well, I spoke to Belcher about this ticket, and he refuses to discuss it, essentially, is what happened. And so I went to Martine Bernal, and I said, well, I want to talk to the city manager. And he managed to give me the impression that the city manager would not speak to me at all, except that later when... It was when the case was resolved, he said, well, he would have spoken to you if you had insisted. Well, I thought I was insisting. So that's my...
So you felt misled.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually, I've had a lot of dealings with Martine Bernal rather than Dick Wilson, who I generally
say hello to as he sweeps by in his silk suits. Martine, actually, I'm on pretty congenial terms with Martine, and, you know, he does make efforts to get me documents that I want, although they're frequent.
That's his job.
That is his job, that's correct. And but I think you know, what we may want to do, those of us who are concerned with the real power in the city lies with the city manager's office. And I think bringing these issues to Dick Wilson is something that we should insist on doing. I think if Dick Wilson had to meet with numbers of people every day about these issues, we might see some real change, because I think he's one of the real powerful figures in the city.
Well, I'm still boycotting every merchant in the city of Santa Cruz because of the way I was treated by city staff and by several elected officials and by the police and by Martine Vermell.
Now, what was the issue? How were you treated? What happened?
Well, that was a bogus traffic ticket.
And how did that come about? Do you want to talk about that, or?
Well, it's a little bit complicated to talk about it. Actually, it was a couple of years ago. But when I actually got a letter from Fred Keeley saying that there was a problem with these two sections of the vehicle code which were contradictory. And so I tried to get someone in the city to pull the ticket.
Now, what were the two sections, and what were you getting the ticket for?
It was passing on the right in partially through a lane that was marked for right turns only.
Okay, I think I've gotten a ticket for that too, actually, but not in this. Actually, on 7th Avenue, I got a ticket for that.
Oh, that would be the county.
Mm-hmm. So what happened? I mean,
well, the judge dismissed the case without trying the case. And so at that point, there was no longer any reason to talk to Wilson, but the fact was I had been trying to talk to him all along, and Martine Vermell told me I couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
And then after I didn't need to talk to him anymore, he said, oh, well, you could have talked to him.
Well, the last time I remember having an extensive conversation with Wilson, other than, you know, occasionally at city council meeting, you can kind of grab him and chat with him briefly. But we actually did a sit-in in his office because Scott Kennedy had proposed it was way back 11 years ago, he had proposed an area in one of the parking garages be allowed for women and children in their vehicles at night if they vacated during the day. And the whole proposal was bottled up in the city manager's office. And Kennedy refused this. He'd become more conservative, and he refused to get it out of the city manager's office. So we got it out by essentially sitting in the office.
Yeah, I heard about that.
That was a long time ago. But
you got arrested, right?
No, we didn't get arrested, actually.
Oh, not that time.
No, actually, that would have been one of the times when we actually probably could have been, you know, theoretically convicted, but it would have been, you know, there were moms and kids doing it. I mean, it was, you know, we had, I think, a genuine grievance, and there seemed to be no other way to light a fire under the city manager than to take some peaceful direct action.
Well, keep up the good work, Robert.
Hey, thank you very much, and thanks for the call.
Okay, bye there.
Phone lines are open, 427-3772. Give a call. Have you had experiences with the city that you want the rest of the community to know about? Again, you know, it's something I say, but I haven't really put it into practice in any effective and continuous way, which has put the pressure on the city manager's office, put the pressure on the city attorney, put the pressure on the staff, because they're the ones who run the city, really.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm getting ready for work, so I only have a minute, but I'd like to hear your comments off the air. I would like to see behaviors that are illegal enforced, not only downtown, but everywhere, and not have people be subjected to harassment and brutality. Two of the problems that I encounter when I go downtown are, I'm sorry, I'm kind of nervous. My voice is shaking.
No, you're doing fine. And take your time. I know you're kind of in a hurry, yeah. So it's kind of hard to take your time.
Yeah. Two of the problems that I encounter are walking through cigarette smoke and seeing cigarette butts dropped on the sidewalk. And, you know, we have a brochure in Santa Cruz that on the front of this brochure it says, The Monterey Bay begins on this, on your street. The Monterey Bay begins on your street. And I see all these cigarette butts in the cracks of the sidewalk, and I think of the sea life, that all these butts are ending up in the bay sooner or later. And the cigarette smoke is just, I feel like I have to run through it sometimes or cross the street to get away from it. And one night I was having dinner, this was some time ago, about a year and a half ago, having dinner at Rosie McCann's upstairs with friends who were visiting, Santa Cruz visiting me.
Uh-huh.
And we actually had to move from one table to another across the room because the cigarette smoke from people downstairs outside on the sidewalk was coming right up the stairwell into the restaurant. It was funneling right up there. Another problem that I encountered, that's one, is smoking. Another one is spitting. I find spitting in public so offensive and so disrespectful of the ground that's being spit on, the earth itself, people around. It's just unbelievable, the people who spit in public. And I think there, what I'd like to do, if it's okay with you, Robert, is take your comments about what I've said off the air. I need to hang up and I'll listen to the radio and have you discuss those to the best of your knowledge, if you would.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that.
Okay, thank you so much.
Sure.
And thanks for the work you do.
Hey, and call in again when you got more time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Wow. Spitting and smoking debris, which is both the smoke and the cigarette butts. I have been a fanatic opponent of tobacco, which is, of course, the most lethal drug that kills the most people every year, more than 430,000 each year in this country. Yet, of course, it's legal, and I don't know that I favor criminalizing it, but I certainly favor all kinds of disincentives, educational programs, and I don't know. I don't favor the death penalty for tobacco executives, but I feel like they should get the death penalty, the kinds of lies and profiteering that goes on around that industry. But the question the caller had to do with behavior in the downtown, and we're talking secondhand smoke has been shown to have a real effect, as I understand it, from my sort of cursory knowledge of the medical reports, and I haven't read it directly, but I take what I get out of the media, I tend to believe it. It has an effect on those around, and it also has a serious effect on people who have asthmatic conditions and other health conditions. And I think that's a reality. You know, that's a real problem. Regarding cigarette butts, I don't know the impact of cigarette butts on sea life, and in terms of, you know, what happens with the disposal, whether they are, you know, weeded out by some kind of system before they hit the bay, or they all flush out into the bay, or whether they're treated, and then, you know, that I don't know, and that maybe someone who does know could advise me on that. But in my main focus is sort of a different one. Though I hate smoking, and I don't contribute to it in any way. If you're panhandling me, don't tell me you're doing it for smoking, because you won't get any money. And in fact, if you're asking me to hand you the pack of cigarettes and I'm sitting in the same room with you, I'll tell you, go get it yourself. I won't pass you the matches. I feel that strongly about it. I am a zealot and a fanatic against smoking. I have been since I was 10. Now, I smoke marijuana myself, so I will pass a joint. So maybe there's a contradiction there, but I don't. Tobacco is so vicious and dangerous a drug, and it is so widely sold, and, you know, it's just such a social evil that I, you know, as a major one health killer. I mean, I think it's above obesity in terms of the number of deaths per year. Maybe not. I mean, I suppose we should start going after those ding-dongs as well. But my focus has often been, because I'm concerned about poor and homeless people, it is one of the pleasures, if you will, that poor and homeless people have. I don't think it's something people should do, but it's also something an adult has a right to make a choice on. Just like drinking. So when I see, for example, officers ticketing homeless people for dropping a cigarette butt, when they tell them to put out a cigarette and then use that kind of entrapment instruction to then arrest them afterward, or not arrest them, but cite them for infraction, littering, I get very upset because I regard it as a form of class discrimination. But that doesn't mean I favor dumping cigarette butts all over the downtown. And Greg Kindig of the Coalition for a Community Commons, who was looking for a plaza downtown, so who supported the Downtown for All petition, and his organization, I believe, either did as well, or he was, as a member of the organization, did, was concerned when I mentioned the instance of how police are harassing people who are dropping cigarette butts, because he doesn't like cigarette butts, like the caller, being dropped downtown on the streets. And I understand that. I don't feel as strongly as she does about it. I don't know what the implications are in terms of the ecological health of the bay. I do have friends who are severely asthmatic and who suffer from the smoking, so I'm kind of giving you a series of impressions. I hope the caller isn't entirely frustrated with my answer. And I haven't finished it, but I'm going to take the second caller and answer the spitting part of the question in a moment.
Hi there, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, I think that they should put in ashtrays. Like, there's no ashtrays in downtown Santa Cruz. Like, show me one ashtray.
Costa Brava inside? No, actually, I don't know of any ashtrays. You're right, Carl.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's kind of like bicycles, you know what I mean? Because, like, if you lock up bicycles, places where they shouldn't be locked up, the city's, like, planned response for that is to put in, like, bicycle parking, right? They don't give out tickets to bicyclists. They just, like, fix the problem by giving a legitimate place to park. So, in this case, the city just needs to put in a legitimate place to put your cigarette butts.
Well, that sounds sensible. What about spitting?
Spitting? Well, you know, like, my first thought when I heard her say that was, like, maybe she should, like, go make her own society or something like that, because it's not very realistic to live in a town of some 60,000 people and expect nobody to spit. I mean, you can be annoyed by it, but that's not realistic to think that all that many people are going to change their ways.
Mm-hmm.
On that one. Anyway, see
you. Thank you.
Yeah, my thought is, it's like watching people pick their noses or something, you know, I don't know. I mean, I pick my nose, what am I going to tell you? Confessions on the air here. If you want to change the rules of social behavior, I mean, you know, you can do that. I mean, there are campaigns, you can organize groups to do it, you can begin public awareness campaigns. Of course, in the old days, they used to have spittoons. Of course, people were engaging in chewing tobacco and did a lot of spitting then, I guess. I'm vaguely remembering from old movies and, you know, which may not be such a good source. So the answer on the spitting thing is, and also, I don't think it's the same kind of health hazard. Now, it depends on where you're spitting, of course.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hi, is this the Etiquette Show?
Yes, it is. I hope you're... Now, don't use any nasty words, please.
I'm not.
Okay.
I don't do that. I'm not offensive.
Well, fuck off. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Yes.
I thought I'd make a comment about the spitting thing, but I did have a little cop watch report for you.
Oh, okay. Well, do both.
The spitting thing, I noticed, I ride a bicycle a lot, and a lot of times we're riding down the street, we need to take a drink of water and spit it out, or sometimes we have a hard time trying to go up hills. I find myself extracting those, or sending out those liquids, those airborne liquids sometimes. So
uh-oh.
I'm probably in violation usually when I'm riding downtown. But that's kind of a health thing that people need to do. Some people have a lot of mucus they need to get rid of right away, and they don't have something to spit into. So it's kind of like having to urinate or defecate, I would say, but not in public.
Well, maybe the city should supply handkerchiefs, or maybe we should encourage people to carry their own Kleenex. Or...
Yeah, we could just put trees on the mall and people could wipe their nose on.
Well, now, of course, see, that was what the earlier caller was concerned about. She didn't like to see people spitting on the ground. And, you know, my thought is it's better on the ground than on the cement, because the cement, it just sort of sticks to your shoes, and then you sit down, you get it on your clothes, whereas you're less likely to sit in the planter areas. Because, A, it's illegal to do that, and, B, it also seems like it might damage the plants insofar as there are any real plants left downtown.
Depends on how toxic your mucus is. But anyway, other things.
Yes.
Other pressing matters.
Well, before you go on to the more pressing matters, let me quickly conclude this by saying you brought up a very important point about the new law, expelling fluids into the airborne liquid deal, which some of us thought, oh, they're after the bubble blowers.
Mm-hmm.
Others thought, you know, maybe they're after those of us who are so sick at heart and sick to our stomachs of what they're doing, that we're going to be vomiting every time we see a police officer downtown enforcing these laws. But, in fact, they may be going after just what this caller is talking about, spitting.
Yeah, I think that's what they're doing. I mean, basically what
they're... Why don't they just say spitting, though? I mean, it's kind of weird. I don't understand why they say airborne fluids, you know. I mean, it's kind of strange.
It's because they can keep it broad, so the officer can go and make his determination on if they happen to see this guy that they would like to run for warrant, for some reason happen to spit on the ground, and they have a reason to come over and run him for warrant.
That's
true.
They
have a reason to harass him.
Yep.
That's only what the ordinance is for.
Unfortunately, you're probably right. Go ahead.
Yeah. The other day on Tuesday, I was left my free radio show, which I do a show on Tuesdays, by the way.
What time is your show?
I do a music program, really, called Pop Defect Radio at 2 o'clock after Democracy Now!
Mm-hmm.
And I'm in there most of the morning and throughout the afternoon putting on Democracy Now! And other news programs, recent updates, all that kind of thing. But I was on my way home, minding my own business, mind you, not looking for trouble, and I noticed... a bunch of undercover officers. Well, it took me a while to figure out they were undercover because there were two white men in jeans harassing some Latino men in San Lorenzo Park. And so I stood and watched for a while. I actually recorded it. I have a pretty interesting recording of it. But
what form did this harassment take?
Well, from what I found out was they were doing a little drug sting operation in the bathroom at San Lorenzo Park, trying to nab those heroin dealers. I'm sure Phil Bear's very happy about that. They did a little drug sting in there, and I watched them for quite a while, for almost an hour, and I was approached by an officer and threatened with arrest for just watching. I wasn't doing anything again, and they just came up, and I was about the same distance away that other people in the park, and they were also harassing homeless people, harassing one guy for drinking, and they were going through another Latino man's bag who was just laying there in the park, not doing a thing, not involved with the whole heroin thing, as far as I could see. And they just walked up to him and started searching his bag, and then they took him over into custody as well.
Now, wait a minute, caller. This is the safe area that all the hacky sackers, frisbee players, and jugglers are going to be sent to.
Right.
Because they're not going to be allowed to, because we're going to have a no-balls mall, as you know, downtown.
Right. Right.
So I guess you're saying maybe they're just sort of preparing the way to make sure that there are, you know, everyone's going to be behaving well in the park.
This is true.
Uh-huh.
You must behave well in the park.
Yeah.
But I don't know. You know, there was also two officers from the MET, the Marijuana Enforcement Team, there to help out. And I'm sure it was a CNET operation, which they're famous for doing these little drug stings in the park and elsewhere, you know, in Santa Cruz. And they nab a couple of people for a couple of little tiny bags of heroin or whatever. And, you know, mandatory minimum, sent the guy away for 20 to life, you know, which I'm sure Phil Bear is very happy about. But anyway.
Now, you and Phil, I have to have you on the show
today. Well, hey, I just realized that I'm not going to vote for Phil Bear. I wouldn't want a fucking drug war guy like that around, but anyway, that's just my opinion.
Uh-huh. Well, let me ask you this about this. When this officer came over and said he was, you know, watch any longer and you're going to get arrested, what was your response?
He came up to me, he says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm observing. And he's all like, you need to leave. And I'm all, okay, I'll step back 10 feet, but I'm still observing, I'm going to observe. He says, you need to leave. And I said, well, I'm going to continue observing. He says, well, then you're going to go to jail. And I said, well, I'm going to step back another 20 feet and step back. I think he realized I was recording. And then he just kind of backed off a little bit, and then he stood there, and then he kept pushing me back and pushing me back. By that time, I was way out of the way. Other people that were hanging out in the park, some homeless people, some not, were even closer than I was, watching the whole drama unfold, you know, like live cops, you know, or whatever.
Uh-huh. When was this?
This was on Tuesday, last Tuesday.
About what time?
In the afternoon, about 2-3 o'clock, about 3 o'clock.
Did you get the guy's name?
I got one. Officer Yanez is one who I asked their name. It's another thing. I said, you're an officer, you need it. Identify yourself. And the two marijuana enforcement team officers, all they had was MET and sheriff on their little shirts.
Mm-hmm.
So I demanded their ID, and they refused to give it to me. And they said they only need to give it to me when they're arresting me. And I said, that's not true. You need to have a nameplate visible if you're in uniform. And then they just, like, kind of laughed at me. And then the other undercover officer, I asked his name. He did tell me his name, Officer Yanez of the CNET squad. And
are these SCPD officers, or...?
One SCP officer showed up. CNET UNED is a combination of all agencies in the county, Santa Cruz, sheriffs, Santa Cruz City, and then Scotts Valley, and whoever else. I think Watsonville is involved in it. It's like a whole county-wide thing. They put together different officers, and then they go out and do these little drug stings on people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, keeping the drug war well alive in Santa Cruz, which people tend to forget about, that this war on terrorism only intensifies the drug war.
You know, I think what we need is some candidates with some suggestions as to how to rein in this war against people, because that's what it is, you know?
That's exactly what it is. You know, you hear Phil Baer talking about heroin. I heard that show. It was absurd. You were just bringing up other points about cigarettes and alcohol, and he didn't even want to talk about them. But I thought you were trying to, you know, make a broad... I thought your interview was well done. I know that you got one critic that day, but I thought you were trying to go into other avenues and see what he was thinking, and... Well, he kind of showed us what he was thinking. He didn't want to talk about alcohol. He didn't want to talk about cigarettes and all that kind of thing. He just wants to focus on heroin.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. I don't know if he's ever inhaled, but...
Well, I think we need more information about heroin in terms of how it's been treated in other countries. And
yeah.
I still don't have that information. I still haven't done that research. And I invite anybody out there who has done that research who'd like to come into the studio and talk about what is Zurich and Switzerland? What is Amsterdam? What is England doing about heroin? There's some that say it hasn't worked. That it's produced more problems. Well, come on in. Let's talk about it.
Right.
I want more facts. But this massive hysteria and paranoia and huge amount of repression, the huge escalation in the jails. I was reading this incredible figure the other day that in 1992, the number of African-Americans in educational... colleges outnumbered the number in jails 3-1.
Mm-hmm.
But as of 2002, there are more people in jail than there are in colleges.
Yeah. Oh,
in
yeah.
black African-American people. So
especially the people immigrating from other countries are now in jail. Yeah.
And that's another matter. But, I mean, I'm thinking about domestic people, even people who were born here. You know, I mean, I don't know whether those figures are but I think it... You know, it's a racist war, it's a class war, it's a stupid war, and you need to deal with it as a medical problem. I mean, and I think the same thing is true with this issue about spitting and about, you know, insofar as it's a medical problem, then, you know, you need to use some public health and safety stuff, which,
right.
You know, might be reasonable. Spittoons, you know, ashtrays. I think we need ashtrays for ash holes on the city council, but that's another story. I'll abandon this. Thanks for your call. Call or anything else?
No, I think that's about it. Just that article that was about heroin in the Metro that I read through didn't mention anything about needle exchange too much.
It was just like a police department press handout. You know, that's the real depressing thing about the Metro and the
yeah.
good times. They are just puff organs for the... You know, authorities and the current status quo, which is failing,
it's
failing, failing.
There's hysteria with people. You know, people all make people more afraid and more afraid and more afraid, you know, and you got to jail these criminals, you know.
Yeah, it's the big drug war. That's it's election eve stuff, too, I think, you know.
So much people like Phil Baer are even running on that ticket. Anyway, I should go let other people call in.
All righty.
Thanks, Robert.
Bye-bye.
And on Phil Baer's behalf, I want to say that he does live in the Beach Flats area, and he does see a lot of direct results of hard drug dealing and hard drug use on his block. And, you know, he's raising a family there, and so he does have a specific concern about that.
Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Yeah, hello, Robert. This is Jim Kostner.
Hey, Jim. Are you in town?
No, I'm actually in Carson City.
Oh, we can't arrest you then. Okay. Well, we'll have to... Go ahead. So what's happening in Carson City?
Well, there are presently 10 native youth that are facing 2 life consecutive sentences for the alleged first-degree murder charge of one Sammy Resendez back in August of 1998. And I was wondering if I may read a brief piece.
Oh, you can read and you can talk about it, too, if you want.
Okay, great. Thank you. Mm-hmm. Well, the piece is from a book called A Little Matter of Genocide by Ward Churchill, who's a member of the American Indian Movement. And... This is a part of the introduction, and just a paragraph I wanted to read. And it says, "Encountering the American Holocaust, the politics of affirmation and denial." And then it has a quote by Adolf Hitler. It says, "The bigger the lie, the greater the likelihood that it will be believed." That's Adolf Hitler. This is a paragraph I'd like to read. "During the 4 centuries spanning the time between 1492, when Christopher Columbus Caribbean beach, and 1892, when the U.S. Census Bureau concluded that there were fewer than 250,000 indigenous people surviving within the country's claimed boundaries, a hemispheric population estimated to have been as great as 125 million was reduced by something over 90%. The people had died in their millions of being hacked apart with axes and swords, burned alive and trampled under horses, hunted as game and fed to the dogs, shot, beaten, stabbed, scalped for bounty, hanged on meat hooks and thrown over the sides of ships at sea, worked to death as slave laborers, intentionally starved and frozen to death during a multitude of forced marches and internments, and in an unknown number of instances, deliberately infected with epidemic diseases. Mm-hmm. That's from War Churchill. It's a very gruesome subject, but yet is reality for...
What's the name of the book?
The name of the book is A Little Matter of Genocide by War Churchill.
Yeah, I think it's customarily agreed, although there are disputes on the extent of the population, that, you know, the Arawaks and numerous other Arawaks were completely wiped out. Of course, the people on the island where Christopher Columbus arrived, you know, and worked to death. And indeed, you raised that point yourself when you smashed the statue of Christopher Columbus in San Jose, California, to essentially get rid of the statue of a war criminal, in essence, a war criminal kind of a conquistador, and then went to jail for it. And I guess now you're in Carson City doing some other political work where you're trying to save the lives of, what, 10 people?
Well, I'm doing support work in defense of Rocky Boyce Jr., who was the first defendant who is actually presently going to trial. He's been on trial last week, and there's still more 2 to 3 weeks of the trial left. And he's being charged with first-degree murder and the beating to death of one Sammy Resendez. And, you know, it's very clear. Rocky, as many people have said, Rocky says over and over that he's, you know, innocent of this charge. He did not kill anybody. He did not beat anybody to death. You know, the facts are very clear in the case when it comes to this. But yet he still, you know, stands in front of a judge who has the power to, you know, sentence and convict him, you know, of this crime.
What about a jury trial?
Well, it's a jury trial, but, you know, that's a whole discussion in itself in terms of who ultimately makes a decision. Mm-hmm. It is a jury trial, and it is an all-white jury, which is another inconsistency in this country when it comes to jury of your peers, which is supposed to be a right. But if it's jury of your peers, one should define what peers means, mm-hmm. because how can all-white jury be the peers of an Indian? That's a contradiction. Also, you have a DA who's making a career off off this case and furthering his career through this case. You have a judge who is a racist and who is a two-faced racist because he demonstrates one behavior when there's not a lot of support in the courtroom and another behavior when there is support in the courtroom. So it's very clear where he stands. The notion that that the jury is ultimately the one who decides, there is fact there in this country, yet it is the judge and the DA who allow evidence to come forward or to stop evidence from coming forward. It is the judge that instructs the jury on what their ruling has to be based upon, and the judge instructs the jury that it must be based upon the law.
And of course...
Not what's right and not morality and not what's true and honest and sincere, but what is based upon the law.
And what most juries don't know is that the judge can be advisory. It's always the jury that has the right to make the final decisions, and the jury can hear everything the judge says, but doesn't have to follow it like some sort of obedient son to a, you know, a wild and crazy father. But has this trial already been held? And has a verdict been given?
A verdict has not been rendered yet. Last week, Rocky was in trial all week. The jury has been seated. There's 100 witnesses in this case. It took 3.5 days to even seat the jury. It's a very long process. Some of the first testimonies were heard last Thursday and Friday, and now there'll be more and more testimonies from witnesses all this next week, and we expect that within 2 to 3 weeks there will be a verdict either way.
Now, this is in how big is Carson City?
Carson City is a town of the same size as Santa Cruz. It's actually 50,000 people. It's 85% white. Santa Cruz is 75% white. Carson City is 85% white. There's 15% non-white. There's out of 50,000 people, you have a 5,500 Latinos and you have 1,500 Indians, you have virtually no Asians and virtually no Africans, and all the rest are white people. And it's a very cowboy hick town, in that the town is actually named after Kit Carson, who was a great Indian killer historically in the 1800s.
What's the business there? What's the main business?
The main business is the mafia, who runs the gambling casinos. You know, that's the main business, actually. And it's so blatant that the mafia and the government are one and the same in this community, that they actually have one of the casinos with the big cowboy in the casino, and it says Senator Casino or something like that. And so they put it out there blatantly. They actually have a restaurant in this town called the Cracker Box. And mm-hmm. that's a blatant, just basically good old white boys town.
How are homeless people treated in Carson City? Do you see many of them?
I haven't seen a homeless person in Carson City, but I know that there was a story where a homeless man was beaten to death not too long ago in Carson City.
Mm.
So I wouldn't want to be homeless here. You know, I wouldn't want to be a lot of things here. This is a very deep town in terms of the system and the oppression.
Well,
and it's really unfortunate that the system has been so, effective in splitting up the Latino and the Indian community. In fact, that there is a gang in Carson City, there's two gangs, but one of the predominant gangs is called the Eastwood Tokers. And it is very apparent that the Eastwood Tokers and the system have a relationship with each other, like many parts of this country, where the white man, the white power structure, not all white people, but the white power structure has historically used a tactic of turning people against each other so that it appears that they're not responsible for what's going on. Mm-hmm. So now they have some elements in the Latino community that have become very reactionary, who actually are in service of white power and actually go against the Indian community and actually go against the community, the people's interest at large. And they have a relationship with the power structure that is very synonymous and very mutually beneficial, so to speak.
So how can people get more information? Maybe there's a website they can go to on the Carson City trial?
There's definitely a website, and that's www.freecarson10.com.
So Free Carson 10, like 10 the number or 10 the word?
10 the number.
So it's Free Carson 10, 10 the number, .com, sorry.
That's the website.
So if people want to get in touch, Jim, they can kind of log on and check that out. And presumably there's opportunities for them to assist in some way at the website?
Definitely. There's a lot of ways that people can help, from great to small. And whatever people are willing to do, we are appreciative and thankful. People actually have come out from Santa Cruz to the trial, to previous hearings, and that we're very thankful to those people. And you can, if you can't come out, there's certainly basic things you can do, like one of the quotes that the sheriff actually said, which kind of shows you what's going on out here in Carson City, is he actually said when he was asked on Channel 2 News basically what he felt about the claim that Indians and Latinos had said that he is discriminatory, you know, as the head sheriff. And out here you have to know that, like, in Santa Cruz, how the city council and the county board of supervisors represent the capitalists in Santa Cruz, and really they're kind of like the shot callers of that community, and the police then, you know, carry out what their dictates are. Here, it's deeper. It's like the sheriff runs a lot of the town. It's kind of like that old cowboy justice, you know, so-called justice. And so the sheriff, actually, this guy named Rod Bannister, Carson City Sheriff, he said right on Channel 2 News, in reference to when he was being questioned about being discriminatory and prejudiced and biased towards Indians, he actually said this. He said, "They feel like they're getting discriminated against. Oh, well, I don't care. Quite frankly, I don't have any use for either of these groups."
Uh-huh.
And now, if that's not... Now, this is a man that's supposed to represent...
Well, we don't want all Negroes. we like it with a good boy, and yeah. Mm-hmm. So... Jim, I know that you were a close friend, this is on another subject, of Evelyn Schoenfeld before she died. This is the 87-year-old activist who fought on local issues for the rights of homeless people, who was a Mumia Abu-Jamal supporter, and who probably would have been up there supporting the Carson City 10 if she could have. Any comments about her passing?
Well, I think a few things about it. I think that Evelyn was a very good supporter and a very good friend to the movement. I think that she did her willingness willingness to speak on almost, you know, any issue shows it's a great tribute to her character. But the fact that when Chaya and Aaron Francis had their baby stolen by the state, the fact that she was willing to go to court when a lot of people weren't is a great tribute to her character. The fact that she came out all the way to San Jose and supported me during the Columbus incidences is a great tribute to her character. The fact that she spoke for Momia over and over and over again, you know. In fact, Pam Africa came to visit Evelyn before she died, and that was, you know, that was very beautiful. The fact that Evelyn actually died with Momia's words, you know, that's she's a very good example of what it is to be a true supporter and a true friend to the movement. Because, you know, we have to recognize that right now in this country there are people who are literally giving their lives, who are risking their lives, and who are actually dying for the people. And the people, to turn their backs on those people is really a nasty thing. It's really a form of betrayal. And many people do turn their backs, and that's really a sad thing. But Evelyn is the opposite of that. She never turned her... Well, I shouldn't say never. Very rarely would Evelyn turn her back on the movement. You know, Evelyn was a great supporter of the movement. And I would just say that... that's something that we all have to face ultimately, is that we all live and we all die, and it's not escapable. That's part of life, and that's what we all go through. And Evelyn had the fact that she lived till 87 is a profound thing. A lot of the oppressed in the world don't make it, you know, past 7 or past 8, you know, much less 87. So a lot of Palestinians out there, they don't even make it till 7 or 8. A lot of Indians all throughout the Western Hemisphere don't make it, you know, past childhood, you know. So
Jim, we've been talking with Jim Costner. I'm going to kind of have to butt in, but I again repeat the website for you to, you know, for folks to go to catch the Carson City 10 situation. Again, it is
www.freecarson10.com.
www or www?
www.freecarson10 the number .com.
Okay. Hey Jim, thanks, and call again.
Thanks for letting me be on the radio.
Hey, no problem. And you're on Free Radio Santa Cruz.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to talk about the caller that called in about his incident with the police at the park.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wanted to make some comments on that, because what he fails to realize is the police aren't there, in my opinion, to harass people. It is illegal to be drunk in public and also to be under the influence of any drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And when he stated there was a guy just laying there, not bothering anybody, most likely that guy was probably under the influence of heroin or some other type of drug. And the police were checking up on him to see whether he was okay, able to take care of himself, or a threat to himself or other people.
Mm-hmm.
What's also not mentioned is there's people in that park that are, displaying nudity or being obscene to others when there's families, you know, children in the park. And the police are definitely needed to be around there, and that's, they do have undercover people to try to take care of the business. So I think that guy was really putting out a biased opinion on that. And also, when they were stating, the police were stating to him, you know, you need to leave, I mean, he can be arrested for interfering with police business. And
But is watching interfering? See, that's...
Watching is not interfering,
uh-huh.
And there's no problems with observing, but mm-hmm. the way it sounded like he was coming upon them, you know, and interfering with what they were doing, you know, by his actions. You know, watching is a different story. People, of course, can gather around, but when you interfere, that's different.
Right. Well, if he was interfering, of course, one would have thought that they might have even arrested him, considering that if his account was accurate, that they took considerable time trying to get him to move, and he did move, but he wouldn't leave like they mm-hmm. wanted him to. And had they... I know I have seen police arresting people for... or actually gotten reports, and I've seen... I've been arrested for interfering with a police officer for not giving my birth date. And the reason I didn't give my birthday was I told the officer, you have my birthday, because the officer had arrested me repeatedly before in a homeless protest. This was 10 years ago. I mean, I wasn't there. I can't tell, and we have only that man's account, and you could well be right. I know that that caller is, in fact, a critic of the police, so
yeah.
I'm sure he does have a certain bias. On the other hand, I don't dismiss him entirely. In fact, I tend to favor what he says, because I know he also has a lot of experience. I've seen him on the streets doing a lot of observing. But let me ask you yourself, you're a resident.
Yes, I am.
And are you, like, do you live near the San Lorenzo Park?
Not too far, yeah.
And what kind of, you spend a certain amount of time in the park, I imagine.
Sure, sure.
And your general, you're not actually giving a specific testimony of what you've seen, but you're speculating on what might have happened.
Right, you know, things that I've observed in the area, you know, from being down there or other parts of downtown Santa Cruz or just in general in the area.
So, yeah. But you of course support the right of individuals to observe police behavior.
Yeah, of course.
And what's been your experience with the police locally? Have you had pretty good experiences?
Locally, I haven't had any problems with the police. I could say probably from when I was younger, 10 years ago, you know, I remember being, you know, as a youth, you know, all of a sudden you're being questioned by the police, what's your ID and why are you here, you know, walking around late at night. And, you know, my experience with the police has changed, you know, and I'm just speculating that's because I'm older and more mature. When you're a youth, you tend to be questioned a lot by the police. And then, you know, and that gets into other things where people will say, well, you know, a young black or Latino male is being harassed by the police. And I'm going to say that's untrue, because as a white male, I could say as a youth that I was harassed by the police also. And I'm just going to say that's probably because I was young. And when you're walking around late at night, they're going to question.
Special guest star Steve Argue.